The Last Bohemian.
Series 2 of The Last Bohemians is a proud partnership with Mr. and Mrs. Smith. Rather fitting, really, as the travel club for hotel lovers has been seeking out those independently minded escapes all around the world since 2003. At MrAndMrsSmith.com, you can browse and book 1,400 of the very best boutique and luxury hotels, the richly coloured, the elegantly designed, and invitingly original. Oh, and of course, the brilliantly bohemian. So whether you're looking for a weekend of R&R, a no-holds-barred honeymoon, or anything in between, Mr. and Mrs. Smith have got the goods. Pat, P.P. Arnold, you've had such a storied career and done so many amazing things. It's hard to know how to start this interview.
I work really hard to survive through the years. I learned that I was a long-distance runner back in the late 70s, so that's helped me. I mean, I'm running for my life. I've stopped running now, but I walk. I mean, my knees, I gotta watch out for my knees.
P.P. Arnold isn't called a sole survivor for nothing. She recently made a comeback with her first album in 50 years, following a long, hard fight at the age of 73 to get her music career back on track. In America, she had been an Ikette with Ike and Tina Turner, and then moved to London at the height of the swinging 60s, where she hung out with Jimi Hendrix and was signed by Mick Jagger to his label. She released the hit single First Cut is the Deepest and two brilliant soul albums, but her third in the 70s, The Turning Tide, which was co-produced by the very famous Barry Gibb of the Bee Gees and Eric Clapton, was blocked from being released. After that, things were never quite the same. She sang with Peter Gabriel, Billy Ocean and the KLF, and appeared in the musical Starlight Express, but dead ends danced with tragedy when she lost her daughter in a car accident. Her solo career floundered until she encountered the British mod band Ocean Colour Scene. Steve Craddock from the band helped her finish The Turning Tide and produced her first new album in five decades, The New Adventures of P.P. Arnold. And what an adventure it's been. Her story is amazing and her laugh is infectious. We went back to the place where it all started, the Bag of Nails in Soho, which is now a sleek members club, to talk about how she's made it. This episode contains discussions of domestic violence, which some may find triggering, and so listener discretion is advised.
Wow, yeah, this is definitely different. This is extremely different than it was. Wow. But the space, it was a big club. And where was the stage? I feel like the stage was the dressing room here? Yeah, the dressing room would have been here. Yeah, and when I peeked out to see who that guy was surrounded by all those women, this black guy from the States everybody was talking about, you know, it was Jimi Hendrix. I first met Jimmy at the Bag of Nails. I was performing there, and my guitar player, Roger Dean, came in the dressing room and told me that there's this guy, this American guy, he's in the audience, and he's a guitar player, and he wants to know if he can jam with the band. You know, so I told him, yeah, tell him he can jam on the second set. I looked out the door, and I saw this guy, this, like, really kind of cool American guy with all this hair and wild thing, surrounded by women. I'm going like, who is this brother, right? So then on the second set, he came up and he played and just blew everybody away. And that's the first time we met. We clicked straight away because it was like a brother and sister in London at the same time, on the same scene, from the same roots. And so I was really glad that he was there because I was shy. You know, Jimmy knew what he was doing. This was his dream. He was living his dream. And I was just kind of going with the flow. I didn't really know what was going on. So everybody always thought that if you're a black girl, you know, you got to be like, you know, black girls always seem to be like so hip and so everything, where I wasn't. So like I was really quite square.
Did you and Jimmy ever write any songs together?
No.
You never jammed?
No, we just made a lot of love together. I was born into a gospel family, a family of gospel singers. We used to have church in my Aunt Frances's living room on Sunday mornings. We just sang. I just remember singing all my life. I never had any training. We used to sing all the old gospel hymns. I love the Lord. I love the Lord, he heard my cry and pitied every moan. I love the Lord, he heard my cry. And that would just all be in harmony. Everybody would just have their own harmony. I mean, I get goose pimples just thinking about it.
I've got goosebumps listening to that, Pat.
I love school, and I was an honor roll student, and I would never, ever ditch school. All my other friends, they were ditching school, and everybody was already kind of, you know, doing it, as we say. But I was just this kind of like good Christian, because I was really afraid. My father was very strict, so I was really afraid. You know, I was told that if you ever get pregnant, I'm going to kill you. So I really took my father's word. I always like tried to obey him. The first record hop I went into, I saw this guy. Everybody saw him. David Arnold. Everybody like wanted David to ask them to dance. For some reason, David asked me. I started dancing with him, and so I sort of like got infatuated by this guy. So David had been trying to get me to ditch school, and I would never ditch a whole day. But he finally kept on and on and on at me, and so I decided to ditch one class, my music appreciation class, because I knew I could make it up with no problem. I used to love to kiss, you know, and he was a good kisser. So I thought, you know, yeah, I'll ditch this one class, and we can do a little kissing and hugging. But, ended up taking me to his house to show me where he lives, and I got pounced on. And, you know, before I knew it, boom, it was over. You know, I had sex, and it was that one time. Then I missed my period. So I got pregnant from that naughty day of ditching school. I wasn't allowed to see David. I didn't see him the whole time I was pregnant. And then suddenly, then after I had the baby and he heard how beautiful this baby was, and he came around, and my father, he did this deal with my father where he could come and see my son. I had a beautiful baby boy, and he could come and see my son if he gave my father $25 a week. I had no say in it, you know, and then he'd come around and there we were playing house. You know, with the new baby child. And so, you know, kind of got involved with him again, and then I got pregnant again. My teenage years were very, very difficult as a result of that. One Sunday morning, I was like doing my Sunday job of like getting everything ready for the week and cooking and cleaning and ironing. And I was washing in the laundromat, and I said a prayer. And I just prayed and I asked God to show me a way out of the hell that I had created for myself. I realized that it was my fault, David didn't twist my arm and make me ditch school that day. He was on me, but I said yes, so that was my fault. And so it was like this whole, my father always had this expression, if you make your bed hard, you gotta lie in it. So I was just lying in my hard bed and getting on with it. I love my babies. I had a beautiful son and a beautiful daughter. And so, like, they were my inspiration to just to keep going. And so, so I said this prayer, and then I went inside, and an hour later, the phone rang, and my girlfriend, you know, said, you got to help us, you got to help us. They had this audition to audition for Iketz. They were singers. That was their ambition. They were singers. And Maxine Smith was a ex-girlfriend of my brother's. And so she knew that I could sing because I sang in church. They were desperate because the other girl that was supposed to go with them, she didn't show up. My husband wouldn't let me go. There's no way he was going to let me go. She goes like, tell him anything. We're coming to get you. Bam, she hung up the phone. The next thing I knew, they were at the door. And I asked David if he would keep the kids for an hour while I went shopping. He thought I was just going to the shops. Next thing I know, I was singing, dancing in the streets in Ike and Tina's living room. And Tina goes, right, girls, you got the gig. I said, I'm going to get in trouble. I should have been home 2 hours ago. And she goes, well, if you're going to get in trouble for nothing, why don't you ride up to Fresno with us and at least see the show? Made sense to me that day because I never had any fun. And there I was in Tina Turner's living room. And this, she was so glamorous and so beautiful. She had took us into her bedroom and showed us all her lovely clothes and furs. And she had, you know, she looked like she just had the life. The day had taken on a life of its own, and I went with it. And so I rode with them to Fresno. I didn't call home or anything. So I went to Fresno, and we were playing this club, you know, a nightclub. I had never been into a nightclub like that. I had left home around noon that Sunday morning, and then I got back home about 6 o'clock that Monday morning, and my husband was waiting for me. As soon as I put my key in the door, he was waiting for me. Bam. And he hit me. He would always hit me in the head or body stuff so people couldn't see that he was beating me up, right? When he hit me that time, it was like he knocked some sense into me, right? I just thought, wow. I remember my prayer. I asked God to show me a way out. That morning, I didn't have a way out. Suddenly, I had a way out. I left my husband because he got even more violent. Because where I had left, and I was like always been told that I was ugly, and I was like the ugly duckling. And then when I came back, being an Iket, I had turned into a swan, right? So I was getting beat for looking too good then. So I eventually ended up leaving him because he threatened to kill me, you know, knife around my throat, you know, crazy stuff. And so, boom, so I left him after that first tour.
What was touring with the Iketz and Tina and Ike like around America? What was that like?
Hard. In those days, you know, like we did the Chitlin circuit. It was like a very, you know, America's very racist. So the Chitlin circuit was the circuit where all the black clubs were in the South. So we would leave LA and we'd go on tour for 90 days. And we were working 87 days out of those 90 days. All through the South, through these little clubs, you know, party clubs. Mostly it was, we do East Coast theaters, like the Apollo Theater in New York, the Howard Theater and in Philadelphia, and, you know, like all the hot theater clubs where all the, you know, James Brown and all the Apollo, you know, so it was great. It was fun, all that part of it, but it was hard. We were traveling and really old, raggedy buses. You know, to me, Ike Turner was like a pimp, right? He called the shots. The first time that I saw him beat Tina, that was really hard for me. I mean, I get really emotional just thinking about it because she had saved me. Being with her saved me and got me away from that situation. And she was so beautiful and so positive and so strong. So that was really hard for me coming out of that and having to deal watching her suffer like that because I loved her so much. I couldn't help her. There was nothing I could do. I'd get fined for crying on stage. So I had to learn not to cry. Because after the gig, Ike and Tina would be back together and I'd be like minus $25 or $50.
How did that circuit in America compare with playing in London? You arrived smack bang in the middle of the swinging 60s.
Right bang in the middle. It was so different. London, to me, you know, you think London, you see all the movies, all the fog and stuff. I didn't know anything about, you know, the scene, the whole culture. And suddenly I was like free. And all those teenage years that I had lost, it was like there I was. I was still a teenager and I was in swinging London, having a ball and all the fashion and the music and the discotheques. Coming out of the Chitlin circuit, and the first gig we played in England was the Royal Albert Hall. You know, so it was like, wow, you know, like a whole nother world, you know. I always say I think Queen Victoria must have turned over in her grave that night because we really, really rocked the house and the Stones and, you know, Jeff Beck and Long John Baldry. You know, loads of great artists were on that tour. I didn't even know who the Stones were. Bill Wyman and Charlie Watts had come to a club that we were playing at in Hollywood, the Galaxy Club, and I had met them, and I knew we were going to play with the Rolling Stones, but I didn't know their names separately, and I thought that the Stones, Satisfaction, I thought that was Otis Redding's tune.
You know, there's a lot of talk now about people like the Rolling Stones appropriating blues music, taking music of black people, and then selling it back to America. What did you make of that at the time?
We were like quite shocked that they were all so good. You know, the blues was a part of my life. My brothers and sisters, we thought the blues was the old folks' music. We knew it and we knew about B.B. King and everybody, you know, but we were into Motown, you know, pop music, you know, the young music. So when I came to England and all these English musicians and everything, and they were like playing the blues and singing it and doing it, you know. So I really had quite an education. I was educated by what I learned about the blues being in England because they knew all of the artists. Mick and I became friends. He used to make me laugh, you know, because, you know, like he always tried to talk black and walk black and be black, you know, and it just to make, just crack me up, you know. This white boy with these big lips, nice lips, very nice lips, and I love to kiss, so like we became good friends. Being with Mick Jagger for the first time, it was really strange. It was my first white relationship, and to wake up next to a white man who was blonde with blonde eyelashes. That was different. It was taboo in America, but it was also taboo in the UK at the time as well. You know, so it was difficult, but I was having fun because like certain things black men didn't do that white men were really good at. So, say no more. So that first 6 months, that was me on my own as a young woman, free, you know, like sort of like just learning about myself and my own sexuality and sensuality. And I was like, suddenly I could pick and choose. You know, I wasn't a groupie. You know, I had my own thing happening, my own thing. And I was very, very independent. And I was picking and choosing too. And I was having a great time. It was really a fabulous time. my relationships with different people were at different times. It wasn't like I was doing it to everybody at the same time. Maybe occasionally.
How did you end up staying in London? Was it Mick that convinced you to stay?
Yeah. Well, Mick invited me to stay, right? Basically, we became good friends. And when the Stones finished, we were still in the UK for a couple of more weeks touring on our own. And so I got a call from Mick one day inviting me to come out to lunch and everything on one of our days off. And so we went out to lunch. And then he, you know, invited me to go for a walk in Regent's Park. And he made me a proposition, you know. He said, it told me that his manager, Andrew Lou Goldham, had this new independent record label, Immedia Records. They invited me to stay in England and sign to the record label. Well, I was shocked, you know, because not only had I not planned to be in the music industry, I had never even thought about being a solo artist. The deal was that I would stay in the UK, Andrew would produce half of the album, and Mick would produce the other half. So Mick insisted that I write my own songs, and I had never wrote a song before, any songs before. So I was just writing from where I was at the moment. I was like the authentic soul singer, you know, with this gospel sound that everybody wanted to work with me. That was the real deal. My deal with my mom was that she gave me 6 months. If nothing happened, I would come home. And if anything happened, I would come home and get my kids and bring my kids to be with me. After 6 months, I had the hit with First Cut. I was able to go home and get my kids and bring my kids back to London. And I didn't stay because of Mick. I stayed because of the opportunity. So Mick gave me an opportunity to change my life.
You were called the First Lady of Immediate Records. What was your experience like and just finding your way through the music industry in the late 60s?
It was really lovely, you know. It was really nice to be appreciated and everything. I've never really been, you know, all off into the celebrity of it all. Maybe if I had been, it would have been a lot easier for me. But because I was shy, which is not a good thing to be in the music industry, you know, I wasn't a hustler. I never had to hustle my way in. I was just, these opportunities just came to me. Things happened. The Speakeasy was like a really great place to hang out in because I was on the road all the time. The Speakeasy was always open late and everybody would be there hanging out and jamming. Brian Jones. One night at the Speakeasy, Brian, I don't know what he was on that night, but he was like making this big prediction about me. He had this sort of like visualized thing about the future with me. And I don't know. I don't know what it was. I'm still hoping that it still sort of manifests while I'm still here, whatever it is, that he was like sort of seeing and prophesizing about that night. But he was
a
lovely guy.
How much LSD was he on?
Maybe a lot, you know. So maybe he could see further into the future than we, you know, that we could. But he was a really nice guy. He really thought a lot about me. He was a good friend. When Immediate Records folded, I didn't know what to do. All the artists sort of like went their own ways. They knew the industry in a way that I didn't know the industry. I just knew what was going on with Immediate Records and with Andrew Oldham. And that was my family. So I didn't know about all of the other managers and the other record labels, how to get a record deal. I didn't know how to get a record deal. You know, because I had just been given one. When I first met Barry Gibb, Immediate Records had folded. Barry and I recorded about 10 tracks. On a business level, you know, he was locked in. His family, you know, that was family business. So he eventually had to get back and start working with his brothers again. Music industry politics are just what they are. Most of the producers that I've worked with have also been artists as well. So when something goes wrong in their camp, it affects me. And business is business. You know, it's really devastating and it's really, really heartbreaking because, you know, I put my all into everything that I do and I've done a lot of great work that nobody has heard.
You say that you were shy and introverted, but you've also had to be incredibly resilient because of all the things that happened with the album that didn't come out until 51 years later.
Yeah, well, that was like, you know, like I'd learned a bit between that period and between 1966 and 1970. You know, I had learned a lot. My friend Doris Troy, she was the first one who taught me how to ask for my money, you know, make sure I get paid. I didn't know anything about the industry. I had to trust people. And I think everybody did. We all did. Everybody got ripped off in the 60s. And as a woman, you know, women didn't have any power. You know, it was like an old boys network. And it was all like young camp boys. It was all about young camp boys more than about. But because I was a black singer, I had that extra thing coming from that cool. I came with the American cool thing a bit, but it was just all about my voice. I was trying to get back to America because it was like all the British invasion was happening at that time. And I was hoping to be able to connect in America as part of being a British artist. They were not interested. I missed the boat. The British invasion did not include P.P. Arnold. Rod Stewart, who I had worked with, well, Rod and I were an item for a minute, and we recorded that Come Home Baby track together. That hadn't worked out. We kind of, that's a whole thing, the session. Mick Jagger was producing that project. With Rod and I, he thought Rod and I would be a good Otis Redding, Carla Thomas kind of duet kind of thing. And it could have been great, but it was just so difficult working with Rod.
How did you feel when he covered First Cut Is the Deepest, your big first hit single that Cat Stevens wrote?
Well, it was cool, you know, but I wasn't happy about, you know, he got paid. I never got paid. And I tried to contact Rod while I was in L.A. and everything to see if he could help me out. And he wouldn't even take my calls, you know. But we had kind of like, you know, we had last seen each other. It wasn't on a good relationship. And so, and, you know, suddenly it was celebrity time. You know, he was always a bit of a celebrity prima donna anyway. And so he was like, you know, you just didn't really want to know. I didn't have the right support system, the management that took us over. It all fell apart. And I had taken my kids with me because we were going to be there for a while. And I thought, well, my family is there, and so they'll be able to spend time with my family. And we had a beautiful home in the Cotswolds, and where my kids were safe and happy, and we ended up selling the house. And 2 weeks later, I lost my daughter in a car accident. I did everything I could to try to protect her, but if anything, I felt that I knew that I was in the wrong place. And so when you have children, when you're in the wrong place, you put your children in danger as well. So for a while there, I felt really guilty because we were in the wrong place.
But she died in a car accident, right?
Yeah, but it was a situation of the accident and the situation that made it, you know, very tragic. I came back to England in 83 because I lost my daughter in 77. I went to Miami in 78. I lived in Miami from 78 to 81, and I tried things there. Then I went back to L.A. to see if maybe I could possibly do something in Hollywood. But I'm too sensitive for Hollywood. Everybody was saying I was too old. I must have been 40. So I was, you know, like I was already, as far as the industry concerned, over the hill, right? So I came back with the Burn It Up, thinking, you know, that's going to, like, I'd be able to get a record deal. I'm the only live thing on the record, and I can't get a deal. KLF, they wanted to meet me, and they were doing the 3 a.m. Eternal and all of that. I brought Katie Kassoon with me, and we tracked all that stuff up. I'm on everything practically that they did with the Moo Moo Choir. And then the 3 a.m. Eternal, I did that lead bit. You know, KLF, uh-huh, uh-huh, uh-huh. So the deal with them was that anything that I did where I had a lead part, that wasn't just a background session. They'd have to do, you know, that's a collaboration. So they were like, so the deal was that they would pay me 5% if they used of whatever, if they used my lead bit. They decided to burn the money instead. And who knows? Hopefully, Bill and Jimmy, if you're listening, you know, you'll do the right thing by me at some point. And then I turn on Top of the Pops and I see some little girl miming to my vocal.
All these years later, 51 years later since you made The Turning Tide, you were sort of rediscovered, is it right to say that?
I fought like hell to get that license back for years and years and years. And I just like bugged the hell out of Universal to get it. And Bill Levinson helped me to find all the recordings. Some of the recordings were in vaults in Germany. Some of those recordings were in America. He found some of those tracks in America.
What was it that drove you to go and find those master tapes in all these different places?
Because I knew they were good, and that was my development from P.P. Arnold at Immediate. That was the next stage of my development. And had those recordings been released, it might have been a totally different story. But I never went back to Mick to ask him for help or anything, because I always felt like he had given me that opportunity, and whatever happened in my life, those were my, you know, bad decisions and whatever. And you can't go back to people. People, you know, when you're young, when then people have families and kids and problems in their own lives. And, you know, I don't know. I haven't seen Mick since 1984. You know, so to show up and ask for help. Maybe I've had a communication with him where I got a letter back that was written by his assistant or something saying, you know, pleased to hear that I'm still, you know, that I'm okay. But, yeah.
Do you forgive easily, Pat?
Hey, it's easy to forgive because I'm not perfect. I do things. I hope that things that I've done in the past to people that I'm forgiven for. And I think it's really important to forgive. I think it's important to let go. I used to really get mad. I used to cry a lot and all of that. Before I go to bed at night and I brush my teeth and take off all the stuff and, you know, and I thank God for helping me get through another day. And I try to let it all go. I do my meditations before I go to sleep, and I do them first thing in the morning before I wake up. I want to go to bed at night and be at peace. I'm letting go of and forgiving everything from that day and waking up and letting divine order take care of the next day. That works for me. You know, I always say that no matter what, I may not have had management, proper management, or anything around me. I always say God was my manager because the universe just always gave me what I needed. I have a way of getting back on the horse every time I fall off. And it's all about keeping the faith, really, and knowing that I've got angels all around me to help me through whatever it is I might be going through.
Why do people call you a soul survivor?
I've managed to survive through the decades by collaborating. So, okay, it may not be my thing that I've done, but I think I've made major contributions to the sounds of everybody who I've ever worked with. You know, I've kind of left my mark there. So it's great to be able to use my gift to project myself. And for me to have learned how to do that and to have confidence in myself to still be out here fighting. I've learned how to fight for my rights and for, you know, and I still got God on my side, still opening up doors every day. Every day something, another blessing. And I stay open to blessings and miracles. My mind, body, and spirit beliefs keep me going. I love the Lord. I love the Lord. He heard my cry and pitied every moan. I love the Lord. He heard my cry.
The Lost Bohemians.
This episode was produced by me, Cass Denton. For more information on this podcast, including guests and the amazing team behind the series, head to thelastbohemians.com.